From the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance weekly podcast, where we bring you interesting people in the world of sports medicine and health. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I'm really glad that you took the time to download us and are listening in. This week is no exception. We have got a great guest. We have Mr. Randy Dick with us. Welcome to the podcast, Randy.
Thank you, Tim. Happy to be here.
Let me take a few minutes and tell everyone a little bit about why we have you on today. Randy has a double master's degree from Penn State and University of Massachusetts. He is a fellow of the American College of Sports Medicine and was on the Board of Trustees. He is a member of the U.S. Lacrosse Sports Science and Safety Committee. He worked for many years with NCAA, managing its Sports Medicine Injury Prevention Program. He was an invited speaker at the 2008 Third International Conference on Concussion in Sport. Currently works for Eli Lilly in a super secret top area that we're not going to talk about today. What we have Randy on the program to talk about today is his initiative that is really starting to take life within the American College of Sports Medicine called Athletes in the Arts. And so the first question we're going to start off with, Randy, is what is Athletes in the Arts?
Tim, we started in sort of a multi-organizational initiative in 2007. We were very intrigued when we were down at a meeting in New Orleans when we saw the Preservation Hall Jazz Band members playing and talking to them about their life as a musician. And the more we heard them talk, the more it seemed to overlap with what we knew about the lives of sport athletes. So we thought it would be neat and actually needed to take and try to apply the knowledge that we put into sport athletes related to nutrition and hydration and practice and injury prevention and apply it to another deserving population that is probably very underserved, which would be the performing artist.
Has this not been done in the past?
It's been done to some degree in the dance world, but I think and we're not discounting the dance world. We're trying to apply it to them as well, but we're not sure it has been done very much at all in the musician world, and so that was a primary focus.
Well, that'd be really cool. So what do you hope to see happen with this initiative?
Well, our mission is to integrate the science of sport and performing arts for the mutual benefit of both. So one thing would be that we could take a cadre of sports medicine professionals, whether they be physicians, athletic trainers, physical therapists, nutritionists, who serve that sport athlete population, and hopefully open their eyes up to expanding their reach to the performing arts population, many of whom don't have insurance but have significant needs that could be met fairly easily by these folks that are treating the sport athletes. We also want to educate that same population of physicians and wellness folks about some of the unique needs of performing artists, for example, hearing loss or focal dystonia, and also apply this to just educating the performing artists themselves about the value of exercise as medicine, and also the music teachers that are also working, or choreographers that are working with these folks as well.
Okay, now I have to ask you, what's focal dystonia?
Focal dystonia, and it's going to get a little bit more scientific than I can handle, but apparently it's sort of a nervous issue. It happens in sport as well, sort of golfers that get the yips when they can't make a putt. Sometimes when people are playing things like a clarinet or a violin, the continued repetitive motion leads to a point where people just are not able to perform that motion anymore.
Is that carpal tunnel syndrome something similar?
It's something different than carpal tunnel. I'm not an MD, so I'm not going to be able to get into the details of it, but it is something that happens not only in musicians and performing artists, but also in sport folks. And people seem to know more about it in the sport world, but they're just starting to learn how it is applicable and concern in the performing arts world.
Yeah, we had a person on the podcast this past uh, couple of weeks, a guy named Chris Chesky, who's up at University of North Texas, yep. who does works with pianists, and that's what they found, if they can use smaller keyboards, that it really helps folks with some of the focal dystonia issue, just because they don't have to stretch so far.
If I'm able to give another name to you, George Scheibert, who also works at part of the PAMA, would be a great person to talk to about the focal dystonia.
Cool.
He did some of our informational stuff.
Yeah. So the Athletes in the Arts, Randy, sounds like a really cool initiative. I know that some of the performers that have been involved with Athletes in the Arts already have just received quite a bit of attention.
We did. We actually, in May, at the American College of Sports Medicine, we have had a launch of Athletes in the Arts, and Amy Yakima was one of the dancers that came and actually did a performance for us. And at the time, we knew she was involved in the Do You Think You Can Dance competition. Well, it turns out that we found out that Amy actually won the Do You Think You Can Dance competition. And so we were very excited for her and also for the possibility for her to be a spokesperson on Athletes in the Arts in the future.
Now, she was in the video that's on the Athletes in the Arts website, isn't that correct?
She is, yes. We had two dancers, that Steve Karaginas, who produced this from Detroit, and Steve should get a good shout-out, brought down for this ACSM event. Sarah, the ballet dancer, who is also a very successful dancer, and then Amy, who was more the modern dancer, both were in that 2-3 minute video, which Steve also just won an award at an LA Film Festival for best sport short documentary. Out of about 400 films, it won that award, and it's on the Athletes in the Arts website if people are interested in looking at it.
Wow. So go check that out. We'll put that link in the show notes for folks, and check out that award-winning video with some performers that maybe you've seen on national TV and you didn't even know it. So let's ask the $64,000 question that you and I chatted about at one point, and that is, are performing artists athletes?
Well, a lot of times when I start off my talks, I'll put up a slide and I'll just say, I won't put what profession I'm talking about, and I'll say something like practice or play every day, play through pain, perform at all times of the day or night, compete in challenging environments, enjoy a little off-season, feel strong pressure to succeed, and risk career-threatening injury. And all of those apply to the sport athlete, and they also apply to the performing artist.
Hmm.
In addition to that, and you very well showed us this by wearing a heart rate monitor while you were playing instruments at the PAMA conference, some of the physical stresses that a performing artist goes through, not limited to dance, if you've ever watched Drum Corps International,
mm-hmm.
Or in many of the folks in the orchestra as well, or some of the street musicians that are out there in New Orleans, they're given a physical effort. There's a weight of that instrument that they're bearing around as well, and they're doing this almost every day of the year. So, yes, they are athletes, and we need to understand that they are athletes, and we need to care for them as athletes.
Now, we'll come back in a few minutes maybe about some potential training that could help from the sports medicine world that could help these athletes. First of all, tell us a little bit about some of the groups that are involved with this initiative, because it's not just American College of Sports Medicine.
Right.
You had mentioned this organization called PAMA, and I know there's some others involved. So what are the other organizations that are involved?
The founding organizations were the American College of Sports Medicine, the Center for Music, Art, and Entrepreneurship at Loyola University in New Orleans.
Mm.
We have John Snyder, who's a 5-time Grammy Award winner producer, who's very passionate about this.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Performing Arts Medicine Association, or PAMA, which has been in existence for several years, and we linked up with them. And then we, subsequent to that, we have the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine, the American Osteopathic Academy for Sports Medicine, so sports medicine groups. Then Consulmer, which is a music manufacturer, instrument manufacturer. Drum Corps International, which I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
The Music Teachers National Association and the National Hearing Conservatory Association, as well as the New Orleans Musicians Clinic, one of the few dedicated musicians clinics in the country. So we have a wide variety of a combination of both sports medicine and music organizations.
Wow. That's really great that you've been able to build that kind of collaboration. And I will say to the audience that so many of the folks that listen to this are kind of interested in sports medicine. If you're interested in this area, you should check out the journal Medical Problems of Performing Artists. And that's put out by the Performing Arts Medical Association. That's Medical Problems of Performing Artists. That journal's been around for, I think, 30 years now.
Yep.
And some really cool stuff in there.
And I'll also put a plug for the website, the Athletes and the Arts website, which would www.athletes, plural, and the arts, all one word, .com. And that is one of our initiatives, is to create sort of a central clearinghouse of information. So there's information there on nutrition for athletes and hearing loss and focal dystonia and performance anxiety and all that type of stuff, with links to the different organizations and the materials that they provide.
Yeah, and we'll put links to that in our show notes as well on the podcast for folks. So let's kind of get back and talk a little bit about maybe some of the ways that sports medicine and performing arts can actually interact. You talked a little bit about the fact that we could maybe take some exercise physiology precepts and maybe apply them to performing arts. Any examples of that, or some ways that we might be able to interact?
Sure. Well, let me if I can frame it a little bit higher level first, and then maybe we can get into a couple of specific examples.
Sure.
One of the very intriguing things to me, as I've been working in this area for a while, and the closest I come to being claimed as a performing artist is playing the harmonica every once in a while.
And you do it darn good,
yeah,
too.
You haven't heard it, but we'll see. Is the fact of thinking about what optimal performance is in the performing arts world. So in the sport world, we can say, I want to run 100 faster.
Mm-hmm.
We can set that as a goal. We can train. We can measure how fast we run it. We can then train, and then we run it again, and if the training works, we get faster. In the performing arts world, whether it's music or dance, it's very subjective. It's like being judged in a diving event or a gymnastics event. And so the first question for me is, how do we metric optimal performance?
Mm-hmm.
Because these performing artists are practicing their craft in music schools and outside of music schools, often 6 or 7 hours a day.
Wow.
With very little break. The NCAA says you can only practice 20 hours a week, and that's one to be sure you maintain your student part of the student-athlete perspective. But in music schools, oftentimes these folks are doing this much longer every day. So the first thing is, how much practice do you need to get to whatever this elusive optimal performance is?
Mm-hmm.
We need to figure out a way to define optimal performance and then be able to metric and be able to measure it. So to me, that's the overarching piece here. And I'm not sure there's a lot of science in terms of saying whether 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 hours will make you a better trombone player or a better singer. And we need to provide our teachers information to help guide them how to do that.
Because that is a problem right now with many of the musicians, is they just practice an inordinate amount of the day.
We do, and then you run into the overuse injuries, and you run into the focal dystonia. So that's the part that can then overlap to the sports medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So the sports medicine practitioner has dealt with overuse and in a variety of senses, and understands how to address that. And so one of the things we counsel our performing artists to do is to track what their activity level is on a weekly basis. We also counsel them to go in and get a performing or a sports medicine physician or some other person in that medical field to be their ally and their colleague before they get hurt, and provide them a list of what they do on a weekly basis, including teaching, because a lot of these people have to make money through teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And they will find that they're probably playing their instrument many hours a day. And so before injury happens, it would be nice to maybe have a conversation between the performing artist and the physician about maybe we need to back off on that. Other attributes would be, okay, if we're going to be starting a new number that is much more strenuous or has much more repetitive motion, we may not want to jump into it right away. We may want to ease into it in the same way that in fall football in the NCAA, and that's what I know the best, the first 5 days of preseason practice in the fall, you ease into it. You have one-a-day practices. The first two or three of them aren't in pads, so so you get ready to acclimate yourself to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
We need to think about those concepts with a performing artist as well. If they're moving into a new orchestral number that is very strenuous and rigorous or intense, then maybe they ease into that and don't jump into it right away with all the repetition and stuff that they may need to handle.
And it's interesting you talk about this because people don't really think about that with musicians.
Nope, but even just think about sitting there. Let's say we are practicing 6 hours a day, and think if you're a violinist, what is the weight of that violin?
Right.
And what is, think of the position, the awkward position with that neck turned while they're playing that violin for that period of time. And so another thing that we counsel folks is take an hour if they're practicing 6 hours a day. Take 1 hour out of that day and either do some physical activity that might strengthen that neck muscle or loosen up the neck muscle, and I'm a big proponent of swimming, or just something to get away from the craft and think about cross-training, things you might be able to do that might help your craft, but maybe you're not doing the exact motions that you would do when you're playing your instrument.
Yeah, you and I were out at a meeting this summer that was coincided with the Aspen Music Festival, and I think you and I both saw the director of the Aspen Music Festival talk about how difficult it has been to for them to get their students, these are kids that are under 18 years old, to do anything other than practice for 7 or 8 hours a day. They can't get them to go hiking. They can't get them to go do yoga or anything.
And part of that may be just because of the, you know, I look at the old football coaches in the 70s that said you can't give them water breaks and give them salt tablets. I mean, that's the way their teachers did it.
Yeah.
And I'm not pointing the finger at their teachers, but we need to provide them good science that says, here's a way, and it all has to be tied to performance. And in order for it to be tied to performance, we have to be able to measure performance in some way that's repeatable. And so I think that's a big challenge in this area.
Wow. So as a musician, we'll focus on musicians here for a few minutes. As a musician gets older, as you and I both know, many of these musicians can play well into their 70s, 80s, sometimes early 90s. How do they get health care for these kind of injuries?
Well, and if you're in New Orleans, you're lucky enough to have access to the New Orleans Musicians Clinic. But most of these musicians are hurting a little bit in terms of health insurance. And a lot of times, since playing is their livelihood, if they go into a physician that doesn't understand what they do, they're going to be told to rest.
Yeah.
They can't afford to rest.
Right.
So
no play, no money.
That is correct. And so it's just a little bit of understanding the life cycle of many of these performing artists. But Tim, you brought up a point about these guys play till they're 70, 80, and 90. That's the interesting part to me as well, that the mental part of wanting to continue to try to get better. A sport athlete, and part of this is physical, but I believe a lot of it's mental, gets burned out and doesn't continue in many cases once they reach 30 or 35.
Mm-hmm.
Yet performing artists are out there having done this since they were 10, and they're at 70 or 80, and they're still playing, and they still love it. And I think that's a great piece of music and performing arts that we need to understand and possibly bring back and apply it in a better way to the sport athlete.
Has there been any literature looking at the cognition of these older musicians, if playing music actually helps stave off dementia or some of these other?
Boy, it's a great point. I have no idea. I'm sure there's somebody that's looked at it. I wouldn't be able to reference or talk about it, though.
Yeah, I think I've seen some of that, and I'm just not really familiar with it. But that would certainly be an interesting question. Maybe we can come back at a later time and talk about that, huh?
Mm-hmm.
As you think about where you're trying to go with the Athletes in the Arts Initiative and some of the emphasis that you're trying to bring to that and in the collaboration between sports medicine and performing arts, do you think there's a future career for folks like what we would consider athletic trainers to work with musicians?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at sort of the whole cadre of what goes on at Disney, that's a great model. They've got so many dancers, performing artists, and they have a whole team of wellness support there. So that's a great model. And then there are classes, or actually schools right now, that are beginning to develop performing arts medicine programs or research. I think you mentioned Chris Chesky. They have a great program at the University of North Texas.
Right.
Ohio University is starting one. I'm blanking on the guy's name. He was at PAMA this year, but he's an athletic trainer, and he's starting a graduate program in performing arts medicine at Ohio University that just launched this fall.
Yeah.
I think there is sort of an online educational program at Shenandoah University that we learned about at PAMA this summer that is also coordinated by an athletic trainer. So I think there's a greater awareness, and there are little pockets of this happening. And then around the world, Brown and Ackerman in Australia supports the Sydney Orchestra and many other activities in Australia. She's a physical therapist, has dedicated her life to bettering the lives of performing artists. So I know people in Germany, I mean, the neat thing about PAMA is there's people from around the world that are all interested in performing arts medicine. And so there are pockets of this, and so I think it's very much growing with a population that is very needy and very underserved. But if, you know, part of my passion of this is, if you think about this, sport and music are sort of international languages.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to know a language to be able to communicate through sport or through music. And so the importance of this throughout the just the whole weaving of the world is in my mind very important.
Well, and I'm glad you brought up the international connection, because that was certainly a point I was going to ask about a little bit. Was about the international scope of this mission that you have, and you talk about the folks in Germany and Australia, and there was Ginny Morton in England, who goes all over the world and talks about, especially with dancers and singers, how to help integrate the two things together. And so that's certainly an international flavor to this whole question.
And there is a Musicians Clinic of Canada as well. John Chong, who's the current member of PAMA, heads that up. So there are definitely pockets where this is important, but many other places where there really is little knowledge about it. I was on the phone last night, and I was very excited. The AMSSM, which is one of our partners, they're the Family Practice Sports Medicine Docs, have their meeting in New Orleans in 2014. So what a perfect place and a perfect audience to get better educated about athletes in the arts.
Oh yeah.
And we just found that we're going to have an opportunity to be on their agenda, and we're going to do two different grand rounds within New Orleans as well, or hope to. So we're going to be educating the different medical schools that are there, as well as Loyola's music school. So in about a 4 or 5 day window, we're going to hit an awful lot of audiences with athletes in the arts in the city of New Orleans, which really is one of the hearts of music in the United States.
Super. Wow, that sounds great. I'm getting the sign that we're running close on time here, and so as we do at the end of every podcast, Randy, I'd like to give you an opportunity to tell us your take-home message. What do you want people to remember from this podcast?
Well, I just want them to think about performing artists as athletes, and that they have very significant medical needs, some of which are very similar to the sport athletes, like nutrition and hydration and injury prevention, some of which are unique, and we didn't even get into the hearing loss too much. And another piece, Tim, that we forgot to mention is Jonathan Batiste, and I'd like just to put in a plug for Jonathan. Jonathan is our artist in residence, about a 25-year-old piano player, New Orleans roots, now lives in New York City, and he's going on tour for the first time around the country starting in October. And Jonathan is a living image of what we're trying to promote. And if he comes to a city near you, look for the schedule. He's a wonderful performer. And in about 15 of his gigs, we're going to be doing educational events about athletes in the arts around the country. So that's another reach out for us that allows us to try to reach these audiences, primarily performing artists, medical folks, and music teachers.
Thank you for bringing up Jonathan Batiste. He is an amazing artist. So, yeah, if you do have a chance to see him, please go see him, because he is great.
Another thing I forgot to cover, one of the neat initiatives that's out there right now is the National Music Teachers Association. There's 644 music schools within the United States, and up until 2011, they had no guidelines on health and safety. They now have a guideline on health and safety, and each of those 644 music schools is trying to figure out how they address that health and safety guideline. So your audience, especially if they are in a town, I'm in Indianapolis, so Butler and IU down the road both have music schools, if they want to reach out to those music schools and try to help educate these music teachers about some things like nutrition and overuse and injury prevention. It's much needed, and there's a great opportunity for folks to make a difference in these music schools, which produce the musicians and the music teachers that ultimately then go out and touch the rest of our kids for future generations. So there's a key opportunity there.
And I would like you to encourage our listeners, if they haven't, to reach out to some of those music schools, because I think they would find willing collaborators there. I mean, we had Chris Chesky on the podcast. We've both mentioned Chris now a couple times from University of North Texas. We had him on the podcast a couple weeks ago, and he talked about some of that initiative as well. So that's fabulous. Yeah, we need to reach out to those folks.
Yep.
Randy, thank you so much for being with us today.
No problem, and it's we appreciate all the interest, and hope your listeners have learned something today. It's a very intriguing field, and even if you don't know a lot about it, go to the Athletes in the Arts website or other places and learn a little bit about it, because there's a real need to help these folks.
Yeah, I agree. And I want to thank all of you that have been listening for taking the time to download us and listen today. And for our regular listeners, you know at this time is when we give you our podcast question of the week. And here is Kelly, one of our producers, with the question of the week.
Why are sports and music considered an international language?
And so there's our podcast question of the week. Be the first one to send us the correct answer at huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of our podcast T-shirts completely free of charge. You know, I'm being signaled to remind people that they're nifty-looking T-shirts, as a matter of fact. So be the first one to send us that answer, and you'll get that nifty podcast T-shirt. So again, thank you all for taking the time to listen. Randy, thanks again for being with us today.
Very enjoyable. Appreciate it.
And we hope that all of you that are listening will join us next week for another interesting person in the world of sports medicine, human performance, and health. And until then, we hope that you stay active and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Cheryl Marek and Kelly Selman and made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell it or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and to talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closing are provided by johnmilesproductions.com, and our music was provided by Dave Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.